This podcast is brought to you by Money Control.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Simply Save at Money Control, a show that talks about money, investments and your savings. In this season, we've been talking to fund managers about the importance to look at companies beyond the numbers. In today's podcast, we catch up with Rajiv Thakkar, who's the CIO of PPFAS Mutual Fund. Now, PPFAS is one of those rare fund houses. It's a small fund house, it's a tiny fund house, but it's one of those rare fund houses that have only a handful of mutual funds, as opposed to, let's say, a supermarket approach by many large fund houses that have multiple products. PPFAS Long-Term Equity Fund also invests in international equities in the same scheme that it invests in Indian equities. But what we are really interested to know is how Rajiv picks stocks, why he has been so consistent in his portfolio holdings, and why reading company management is so important to him. Did you know that Rajiv locks himself up in a public library one day every week just to read up? In fact, his office at Nariman Point 2 has a nice quiet library in one corner. Now let's quickly meet Rajiv to understand that consistent and solid performer behind a gentle exterior.
Hi Rajiv. Good morning.
Good morning.
And good to have you with us on our podcast.
Pleasure being here.
If I'm given to understand, you're close to completing your 2 decades now in Parag Parikh Financial Services.
That is true. More than 18 years now.
Okay. And your PPFAS Long-Term Value Fund has completed, 6 years now here?
Yes, it's called a Long-Term Equity Fund now, equity but yes, fund. 6 years plus
okay.
now.
Okay. You know, you've been managing funds for so long. We thought, let's just catch up with you on, you know, the finer aspects of stock picking, which sure. our listeners can learn from you. Obviously, a lot has been said about numbers and, you know, we talk about balance sheets, annual reports on a daily basis, on a regular basis. But what I want to know from you is that what else do you see when you pick up stocks? That's what our listeners most want to know from you. Specifically, the qualitative aspect of research. You know, so tell us, Rajiv, by starting explaining as to why it's important for you to, as a stock picker, for us to go beyond what's publicly available.
True. So there are two schools of thoughts regarding this. So some listeners may be familiar with a person called Joel Greenblatt, who has written this wonderful book called The Little Book That Beats the Market.
Okay.
Now, that approach is purely number driven, where a certain formula is applied in terms of quality of the business and in terms of cheapness of the stock.
Okay.
And a joint ranking is given and you buy the top ranked 30 or 50 stocks and you reshuffle at the end of every 1 year.
Okay.
And based on back testing and some real world applications, it's done reasonably well.
Okay.
And again, these days, the fashion is of quants where people just apply numbers and supposedly some of them do well. And you also have people who are purely quantitative, where they don't go through a lot of qualitative factors, and some of them seem to be doing fine in a larger, broadly diversified kind of approach. There is some advantage to that, but where such an approach typically misses out is that most of these numbers are backward looking. So, a reported return on equity, a reported growth rate, all refers to the past. It does not tell you anything about the future. So, qualitative aspects typically come into play where one has to identify the discontinuities going forward.
Okay.
That is one place where qualitative factors matter a lot.
And also something, I suppose, areas where, you know, you want to have an edge over your competitors, over your peers. I mean, something that you would want to know exclusively through your understanding of the business. That's where you can make a difference, right? I mean, published numbers are available with everyone.
True. So, one can get an edge by some qualitative work. But that edge typically comes in small and mid-cap companies or in unlisted or in recently listed companies.
Okay.
Because people who are large enough and who have been listed for long enough, typically most of their information is already widely known. It's only when some sector is very, very new, where either the promoters are new to the market, where you need to do your own background checks and really decide whether something is worth investing or not.
Okay. Like, for example, what, like your insurance, we've had quite a few of insurance companies being listed. That is a first area, nascent sector where the first few companies have got listed. Any other examples that you can give of such new sectors that have come up in the last 5 years in your tenure over here?
So I have a slightly different view on insurance. Okay. So although the listings may not be very old, the promoter companies have been around for many, many decades.
Okay.
So it's not that ICICI is an unknown entity or SBI is an unknown entity or HDFC Group is an unknown entity. Also, these insurance companies had a pretty long operating track record before they got listed.
Okay.
Newer business, let's say in the global context, let's say something like a Uber or a Lyft getting listed or Amazon, which got listed many decades back. So if you were investing in the late 90s, you would not have much background information on Amazon.
Okay.
And
okay.
You would have to do a lot of on-ground work. So, IRCTC, for example, in the Indian context, which, again, it has a long operating history and Government of India is not unknown, but some aspects of it would not be that well known. Or Info Edge, when it got listed, that would be a company where qualitative work may do a, may make a difference rather than just a quantitative approach.
So, you're saying that it's more to do with the small and mid-cap companies, the companies that are newly listed, where this kind of digging around is essential and it builds upon your repertoire of your quantitative research. But in case of large and established companies, there's not much work over here that ought to be done.
True. And so, it applies to small and mid-caps and new listed, as well as where there are discontinuities.
Okay.
So, to give an example, in the auto space, the large car companies, two-wheeler companies are well known, but arguably electrification will be a discontinuity and the winners may not necessarily be the same companies.
Correct.
If you are looking at and analyzing companies in the electric vehicle space, then a lot of qualitative work may be needed.
Okay. And how large is your research team, Rajiv, considering that you have just one fund?
We have nine people in the
team. So, nine people doing research on just one equity fund. Okay.
Yes.
So, do you rely more on in-house research or do you also talk to other brokers who come to you with sell-side ideas?
So, our mailboxes are typically flooded. So, we get more material to read than what we can practically read.
Okay.
So, just like more hours of video are uploaded on YouTube per minute than what anyone can watch.
Correct.
And even a lifetime is not enough to watch all the stuff that is out there. A lot of research gets published.
Okay.
Finally, when we have something in our portfolio, the responsibility for that investment lies with us.
Okay.
So, we cannot claim that, oh, we relied on this sell side report.
But you do get ideas.
We do get ideas. The situation is that in some areas, there's over research. And so, each quarter, Infosys may have 20 to 30 quarterly updates coming out. And a lot of it actually repeats stuff which is there in the result announcement and things like that. And not enough meaningful differentiated research is there.
Okay.
So, one has to really filter all the reports coming in to really identify what is of interest.
Okay. So, now tell me when you go and meet companies, by the way, do you go and meet companies?
Yes, wherever required. So, it's not a thing that we are continuously running around and never in office and always meeting some company.
And you run a multi-cap fund, so you have a lot of investments in large caps. You will have some investments in small and mid-caps also. So, and it's just one fund.
True. So, yeah, wherever required, we do meet companies.
Yeah.
But again, a lot of the work is also desk work. A lot of the work is also meeting with people in the value chain, suppliers, customers, kind of thing, not necessarily people working with the company.
Okay. But you do meet people who work for the company, like let's say the management or someone. Who do you normally try and meet? Like, do you try and go for a CEO or do you go a little bit down the line? What sort of a mix of people would appeal to you enough to get the information that you are looking out?
Wherever the business is complex or we have some aspects of the business that we don't understand, meeting with the senior management helps. For a layperson, understanding life insurance is not that simple. Or for it's different from a lot of other businesses or even financials for that matter, where the balance sheets disclose aggregated numbers, where this much is the lending or this much is corporate advances, this much is retail advances. But really what is happening within that piece, full clarity may not be there just looking at aggregate numbers. So you may want to know which segments they are focusing on and what are the trends in those areas kind of things.
And at the times you do meet the CEO himself or herself.
Yes.
When need arises.
Yes.
You know, do you go for plant visits also when it, wherever it's required?
We do that once in a while. But personally, I have done more plant visits as a CA trainee for stock taking than I have done as a
fund manager.
What happens is, for larger companies, the visit to the plant typically requires travel to and fro, and then one full day is spent at the plant. And the insights may not be that much. So just as an example, I believe on Netflix there's a documentary which covers Hero MotoCorp's plant. And it's as good as a plant visit. So if you just watch that documentary for half an hour or 1 hour. So for larger companies, there may not be much that you get by visiting a plant. And again, these days a lot of companies are services companies. So visiting Infosys campus and watching people typing away on keyboard
isn't going to
tell you much as to what is happening. Or if you visit Airtel's telecom towers, that is not going to give any significant insight to you. Where it helps is that, especially for, as I said, small and mid caps or new listings, sometimes it brings out suspicious things. So, for example, if a company is claiming to be 10,000 crore turnover company, and if the plant has a few people here and there and very limited inventory and limited raw materials, then clearly the suspicion would be that there are inflated numbers being reported or things like that. So as a basic due diligence, it may help in relatively unknown.
Have you seen such cases yourself?
Last year, I believe some of the fraudulent things came out and they were covered in the media, where the either the distribution network that was being spoken about by the company was non-existent largely, or some of the sales numbers were inflated and things like that. So in 2018, where a lot of mid-caps got beaten down and some governance issues came to the fore, those could have been prevented by a more diligent visit to the facilities of the company.
And when you meet the company management, when you meet the CEO or whoever senior member of the company, how do you assess whether the person is telling you the truth or not? Especially if it's a new company or if it's a small and mid-sized company where not much information is available. What else can you do as a fund manager?
That's a very interesting question and a very helpful question for a lot of investors, because this is typically where we tend to slip up. So one interesting documentary which has recently come out has been on Theranos and the founder, where the company was fraudulent and they were making claims that were later turned to be untrue. We have again a documentary on Enron, the smartest guys in the room, which again is a brilliantly made documentary. There's a book called Lie Spotting, which again gives you techniques as to how to figure out whether someone is telling the truth or pulling a fast one. Some of these, after one reads the book and one sees some of these documentaries, one tries to see whether similar patterns are repeating in your interactions with people. But the simplest way, especially for a company with a longer track record, is to see what they have claimed in the past and what their behavior was subsequent to those claims. So if someone consistently says we'll grow sales at 20% and each year the actual growth is 5%, that means they are either in a pattern of over-optimism or they are in a pattern of lying. Or if they make verifiable statements which later turn out to be untrue, then that means that the person is a habitual liar. So you may not be able to catch whether each statement they are making is true or untrue. But if they have a pattern of lying in the past, likelihood of that being repeated in the future is high.
Do you also get to speak to the channel partners, like people around the company, the ecosystem?
That's a very valuable source of information, actually. And in fact, some of it has become virtual these days. So these days, you have websites which talk about the employment conditions at different companies. So there's this website called Glassdoor, or people may be running discussions on LinkedIn. through your LinkedIn contacts, you can figure out people who are ex-employees at a company that you are researching. In fact, ex-employees may be a good source of information because they don't have any vested interest.
But they could also carry a grouse.
True. One has to keep that in mind. So if the separation has not been on amicable grounds, either because of performance or some wrongdoing by the employee, then that opinion could be colored. But if it's a repetitive thing coming from multiple sources, then obviously it is a strong signal.
Okay. So give me an example in recent years. You may not name the company if you want to, but any recent examples where you may have found something incriminating or something contrary from the ecosystem as opposed to what the management would have given you, and that would have influenced your decision to not to buy a stock or to avoid a stock. Anything of that sort that you can share with us?
Sure. So in 2018 and in 2019, we have had plenty of blow-ups in some banks and in some NBFC or housing finance companies.
Okay.
Now, in a lot of companies, the growth numbers were looking excellent. The reported NPA numbers were very, very low. And the talk was that some of these newer companies are almost as good or maybe even better than the well-established companies like, let's say, a HDFC or a HDFC Bank or a Kotak Bank or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, these things would not come out from reported numbers.
Okay.
These things would come out only from on-the-ground work as to what is the credit culture, whether they are conservative in lending or whether they are aggressive in lending. And things like that. So, as one experienced investor was telling me, sometimes you can't see and hear things, but you smell things.
Okay.
Meaning, if the stench is bad, then you stay away from some investments. So, doing on-the-ground work helps in that area.
Okay. Rajiv, you also invest in international companies in your portfolio.
That is correct, yes.
And you're one of the few funds who invests in international companies as well as Indian companies in the same fund. And you do it quite liberally. You go up to 40-50% also at times.
Our maximum is 35%. Typically, we are at 30%.
Okay. Exposure to international
companies.
So, how do you do your research when you invest in international companies? And do you deliberately go for those companies, large, well-established companies with a long track record where everything is out in the open? Or do you go for manufacturing kind of companies where you might have to go for a plant visit or you might have to see their facilities?
So, that's correct. We are not buying into very, very small companies. Essentially, we are trying to participate in the global economy and have global diversification. And from that point of view, the companies that we buy are global multinationals. So, visiting any particular country of operations of that company will not give us any specific advantage.
Okay.
Just to give an example, let's say Nestle, which in theory is a Swiss company.
Okay.
Their headquarters is in Switzerland.
Yeah.
But their revenue from Switzerland is very little.
So they
operate.
Company.
Yeah, it's a global company. They operate in North America, Europe, Asia Pacific, Africa, various places. So being in a particular country or some other country is not an advantage or a disadvantage as far as stock research goes. We stay away from companies where we would need to do on-ground work.
Physical verification.
Yes.
Yeah.
So for foreign companies, it's largely work that happens from our Mumbai office.
Okay. But do you speak to international investors, let's say, get a second opinion about the company? For instance, Apple, how sales are going over there, or any other, let's say, Uber, because that's a company that's, because some of these companies have had problems with the governments of different countries and, how those things can affect their revenues. Do you get a second opinion? Do you go for a second opinion in those kind of companies, international counterparts?
Yes, absolutely. So, the network that we have in the US is pretty strong in terms of both investors as well as people working in the tech field.
I see.
There are people we interact with who are based in San Francisco. There are people who are in the financial sector in New York and other places. So, we interact with people, we meet them, we interact via email and phone. So, interaction is pretty close in that sense.
Okay. And any other kind of due diligence that you carry out before you invest in an international company?
Typically, it would be
a newly listed company, for instance. Would you go for it?
So far, we haven't invested in very recently listed companies. Okay. We have largely been invested in companies which have had some amount of track record.
Okay.
The approach is more or less similar to what happens in India in terms of quality of promoters and management, quality of business, future outlook and things like that. If there are any specific requirements as to country of listing, or if a particular security has certain characteristics, let's say voting rights versus non-voting rights, or some special terms linked to depository receipts and things like that, those we would evaluate. But other than that, bulk of the thing is similar to what happens in India.
And Rajiv, do you ever find yourself in a situation where you bought a stock, you had done a lot of research, you bought something, you liked it, okay, but a few months down the line, the story has changed. Okay, what do you do in those cases? Do you still hold on? Of course, we're all experts in hindsight.
Yes.
But in that particular spot where you are in, how do you tackle that kind of a scenario? Do you take a stop loss and get out? Or do you try and persevere and see and drag it on for another couple of years to see if it turns around, and then you take a call? How do you approach such a tricky scenario?
Okay. So firstly, we don't operate on a stop loss based on stock price. So it's not that if the stock price has fallen by 10% or by 20%, we necessarily sell something. If that were the case in 2008, we should have been in 100% cash, because everything fell by 20% or thereabouts. So obviously there are investment mistakes that happen all the time, because finally investment is a probabilistic game. Even the best investors will not have 100 on 100 correct outcomes. Even a 60-70% strike rate is very, very good, as long as other disciplines are in place. So the recognition of investment mistakes happens not on basis of stock price movement in the near term, but on the basis of business outcomes. So for example, there was a company we had invested in which was linked to the education sector. Now at the time we invested in, it was more of a private education kind of business, and later on they got into a different kind of business which was very capital intensive and which had long receivable cycles and things like that. And we realized clearly this is an investment mistake, and we exited it.
So you exited it immediately.
So when we decide that a company does not make merit being in, then the purchase price is not that relevant. So we may be incurring a loss, we may be breaking even, or we may be making a profit. If the decision is to exit, then we would typically end up exiting.
Does it also help that you are a small size fund, so it's easier for you to get in and get out? What if this would have happened in a very large size fund where you realize that, you know, things have changed in the company where you have invested in, but if I get out, it's going to get send a wrong signal to the market?
So for any sized fund, whether it's a small sized fund or large sized fund, if you own so much of a company that your buying or selling will impact the price in a very, very big way, then effectively you are to some extent having characteristics of a private equity fund or a venture capital fund kind of thing. So the time to look at this is when you are buying the stock rather than when selling the stock. So again, if our holding as a percentage of overall free float is very large, then we would have a large impact cost while buying also. In which case, most of the gains from our investment would be taken away by impact cost while buying and while selling.
So you're saying that you don't even want to get into that situation, let alone be in a situation later on where you have to decide whether you want to sell or not, even though it's a compulsory, it merits a sell.
So it's not a complete no-no. What happens is sometimes the opportunity is very, very attractive, where you willingly take a liquidity risk. But you have to look at it in the portfolio context. Now, if you have a portfolio where, let's say, 5-7% of your investments are relatively illiquid, and where you can meet redemptions out of your liquid investments, then you may willingly take such a position if something is looking very attractive. And again, if fundamentally something is wrong, and if your selling is going to cause a dent in the stock price, then so be it. We have to work in investors' best interest.
Bad investment is a bad investment.
Yes.
Okay. Rajiv, I want to turn your attention back to what you had said earlier about using channel checks to, or rather going through the ecosystem to check the company and get a second opinion.
Yes.
You had said about instances where you might rely on, let's say, something that's popped up on LinkedIn or something that's been doing rounds on, you said example of a LinkedIn.
Yes.
So, you know, broader question about that. Do you, social media is a big phenomenon these days. So
yes.
News breaks first on social media nowadays before even it comes on in TV or in the newspapers later on.
Yes.
But there's a, you know, there's a flip side also to it.
Yes.
So how much do you rely on social media these days when you want to have a second opinion about the company?
So there are two elements to it. One, it could be a signal, and second, it could be noise.
Hmm.
And one has to clearly distinguish between the two.
Yeah.
One has to realize the strengths and weaknesses of social media.
Okay.
So the strength is that you can aggregate opinions of a large number of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, Amazon buyers' reviews and where a product has been sold by the millions.
Yeah.
If that buyer review is 2 out of 5, then obviously customers are not very happy. And if that review is 4.5, then obviously it's had a good customer satisfaction. Again, some things like trends in Google search are aggregated over millions of people or maybe billions of people, and which are very important indicators. Sometimes there may be orchestrated social media campaigns or some influencers are trying to create a wave one way or the other.
Mm.
So that could be more like a noise, or sometimes ephemeral trends may come out which really don't merit so much attention. So one has to surely use judgment in these cases, but the advantage is speed and scale, which otherwise is not replicable elsewhere.
Because I remember, this particular financial services company, we used to get a lot of research reports and a lot of buy recommendations.
Yes.
For a whole period of 2 or 3 years before that institution kind of collapsed or got into big trouble, which it still is. Okay, I don't want to name the company, but a lot of research reports kept coming in. So what you're saying actually also makes sense, that it could be an orchestrated noise, or it could, on the other hand, it could be a genuine news information that can come. But you have to be a little judicious, you're saying that, to figure out whether that's something that will be taken cognizance of or whether you should avoid that.
Correct. So what happens is when multiple different sources of signals point in the same direction, that has far more validity than some signals giving a positive indicator and some signals giving a negative indicator. Just as a example, if let's say 100x employees, out of 100x employees, if 90 people have negative things to say, if 90% of the suppliers have negative things to say, if most of the customers have negative things to say, then it's
it makes more
clearly something is wrong.
Correct.
Whereas if a few ex-employees rant against the company and a few of them are supporters, then obviously it's a confused kind of signal and one can ignore it.
Okay. Rajiv, last question I want to, actually two questions I want to quickly ask you. You attend the Warren Buffett the annual Berkshire Hathaway conference in Omaha every year. So what are the biggest takeaways that you get from there, and what's your experiences? Tell us, like, what happens over there. You know, is it a very well-attended conference? Do you get to interact with Warren Buffett himself and Charlie Munger? Are they very articulate in what they say?
Okay, so the good thing for the last few years is it's been live cast and people can watch it in the comfort of their homes.
Okay.
Typically, it would be home and not office since it happens late at night.
Correct.
But people can watch it and get the experience.
Hmm.
It's obviously a very large event. More than 40,000 people attend it, I believe. So the chance of getting to interact with them personally was a few decades back. These days, it's a very, very large event, and obviously, you don't get to meet them or interact with them.
Okay.
And
but you can get to ask them questions.
That also depends on luck of the draw, meaning the questions are split three ways.
Okay.
So one group which gets to ask questions is financial journalists. The other group which gets to ask is analysts covering Berkshire Hathaway stock.
Okay.
And the third segment is the live audience.
Okay.
And given that there are so many people, maybe over the 6-7 hours that the meeting happens, there may be 25-30 live questions. So that also is not a given.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you are not waking up early enough to stand in queue, you may get a seat which is very behind, very far away from the stage, and you actually see them only on screen.
Okay.
Or sometimes you may not even get into the main hall and watch
and
it on screen.
And this is done at the Berkshire Hathaway office center?
No. Yeah, so it's held in Omaha.
Huh.
The Berkshire office is in a is on one floor in a nondescript building, Kiewit Plaza, I think, Kiewit Tower in Omaha on Farnham Street. That office will not accommodate a large number of people. So maybe max 20, 30, 50 people can be there. This is actually in a stadium in downtown Omaha, where otherwise there would be maybe games and all happening, sports events happening on non-Berkshire.
Okay. So how long meeting. This entire event takes place?
The door, yeah, so I think 3 hours and 3 hours, two sessions each, plus there is time for formal agenda.
Okay.
So 3+3 would be the Q&A, and there would be some time for some official resolutions and announcements.
Do you get? Have you ever implemented some of the key principles that Buffett has always elaborated on in your investments?
Principles, obviously, we try and implement not only from what is said at Berkshire, but his letters and his books written about him, his talks at various events. The interesting thing was that one of the book recommendations by Charlie Munger at the event actually led to one investable idea which has done pretty well for us.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice to know. And Rajiv, last question. Recommend 3 good investment books or non-investment books also for our listeners.
Okay.
You have a big library in your office.
True.
You've shown me around in your office when you moved over here. And it's quite an impressive library right in the heart of your office. But tell me 3 books that you...
Okay. So, I'll give maybe 2 non-investment books and 1 investment book. So, in non-investment books, Deep Work is a very relevant book for the times that we live in.
Deep Work.
Yes. So, it talks about how to focus on work by cutting out a lot of distractions, and which is the bane of the modern life.
Okay. Sure.
The other book I would recommend is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Okay.
These are the 2 non-investment books. And for recent investors or lay investors, One Upon Wall Street would be a good start. Yeah, either One Upon Wall Street or The Intelligent Investor. One of the 2 could be picked up.
You spend what, 1 day of the week in a library? You had told me that.
Yes.
So, like what, you just shut yourself out from work and world and 1 full day you spend at the library once in a week?
Yes. So, it could happen at a library or sometimes it could happen at office.
Okay.
But on that day, no phone calls, no emails, no meetings.
Okay.
Just spend time reading. So
just spend time reading the whole day.
Yes.
Okay. Nice talking to you, Rajiv. Great talking to you as always.
Pleasure talking
and
to you.
And thank you so very much for your valuable insights and guidance.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Over the next month and a half or so, we'll bring you many such conversations with some of our top fund managers around. If you have any feedback, anything to say, or any queries that you want to write to us, our email ID is mcpodcast@mw18.com. I repeat, it's mcpodcast@mw18.com. For more news, views, and updates, log on to moneycontrol.com.